Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.17, Balkan Liberation. Well, boys and girls, we have done it. We have reached the end of part one of this season. And yeah, this season is turning out to be a bit longer than I had originally thought, but I'm certainly having fun with it, and I hope you are too. So after today, I will be taking a two-week break while I recalibrate and prepare us to dive headlong into the Young Turk Revolution of 1908. And I haven't mentioned this, but I also have a beautiful 11-week-old baby to look after, so maybe I'll catch up on some sleep, though probably not. But it'll be a good break nonetheless, and there is a lot more to look forward to when we come back. And in the meantime, you know, maybe write a review or share this with your friends. And we will keep having fun with it. All right, on with the show. The imperial rivalry between the Russians and the Ottomans has some very deep roots. When Mehmed the Conqueror took Constantinople in 1453 and toppled the Byzantine Empire, it was said that the second Rome had fallen. The first Rome had, of course, been Rome itself, but when the western half of the Roman Empire fell in the 5th century AD due to many factors, see Mike Duncan's podcast, the center of gravity within the Roman Empire shifted to the east, with Constantinople emerging as the so-called Second Rome. And so was born the Byzantine Empire. And we must remember that calling this Eastern Roman Empire the Byzantine Empire is just a modern descriptor, and the people at the time continued to call this political entity the Roman Empire, and the people within the empire called themselves Romans. But there would, of course, emerge some major differences between the classical Roman Empire and the medieval Byzantine Empire, hence the distinction made by historians. Apart from the obvious move of the imperial capital from Rome to Constantinople, the other major difference was, of course, the rising importance of Christian Orthodoxy, which had been declared as the official religion of the empire even before the western half of the empire had taken its last breath. And then fast forward 1,000 years, and the Byzantine Empire was itself beginning to collapse due to many factors. See Robin Pearson's podcast. And this opened the door for the Ottomans, who, as we noted in episode 1.1 of this series, actually considered their empire to be a continuation of the Roman Byzantine Empire, with Mehmed the Conqueror styling himself Caesar of Rome. But while the Ottoman sultans were taking on the hallowed name of Caesar as the political and geographical successor to the Roman Empire, farther to the north, the princes of Moscow were also growing increasingly powerful as Ivan the Great drove out the last remnants of the Golden Horde, descendants of the great Mongol Empire of Genghis Khan. And thereafter, Ivan the Great would proclaim himself Tsar, often translated directly as Caesar. And indeed, during Ivan's reign, the newly proclaimed Tsar Ivan would increasingly be referred to, as one Russian Orthodox leader put it, quote, the new Tsar Constantine of the new city Constantine, Moscow. And of course, Constantine here is a double reference to the first Roman emperor to adopt Christianity, Emperor Constantine, as well as to the Byzantine capital of Constantinople, which was named after Emperor Constantine. And so, as the princes of Moscow declared themselves Tsar, so was born the so-called Third Rome, and from this point on, the Russian Tsars would consider themselves to be the spiritual descendants of the emperors of Byzantium, and their capital in Moscow to be the Third Rome. So, as the Eastern Roman Empire fell, two new empires would lay claim to its legacy, with the Ottomans claiming its territory as the new masters of the Mediterranean world, and with the Russians claiming its religion as the new leaders of Eastern Orthodoxy. And then, of course, you've also got this other thing called the Holy Roman Empire, but those guys saw themselves as the successors to the fallen western half of the empire based in Rome and based in Catholicism. Yeah, a lot of people trying to build on the hype of Rome. For a while, the conflicting claims of the Byzantine legacy did not lead to any direct military engagements, as Russia was still far off to the north. But over the next few hundred years, the two empires would eventually become neighbors, as Suleiman the Magnificent went a conquering to the north, and a little bit later, Peter the Great and then Catherine the Great went a conquering to the south. And so the two empires would meet, and from then on, southeastern Europe and western Asia would become their battleground as the two great empires faced off, fighting a war just about every 20 years. And if this were, I don't know, a rivalry in college basketball or something, the overall record would be around 7-2 in favor of Russia, with a few ties thrown in there. So it was never quite an even matchup, and in the big picture, this really is best understood as a steady Russian advance southwards at the expense of the stagnating Ottoman Empire, as the Russians pushed the Ottomans out of Central Europe and took control of the areas around the Black Sea, namely the Caucasus of modern Georgia, Azerbaijan, and of course, the Crimea. And for the Russian Empire, this steady advance southwards was explicitly understood in religious terms, as the Russian Tsars saw it as like their cosmic mission or something to expand Eastern Orthodox Christianity and to drive Islam out of Europe. And as we noted a couple episodes ago, in human terms, this Russian expansion to the south led to some catastrophic consequences, as the Muslims living in southern Europe and in the areas around the Black Sea were steadily replaced by Orthodox populations through mass deportation and genocide. The ultimate goal of this cosmic mission of the Tsars was always Constantinople. For centuries, the Russians had referred to Constantinople as Tsargrad, pointing to the Russian belief in their prophetic destiny to restore Orthodox Christianity to the lands of the old Byzantine Empire. Naturally, the Orthodox Christians living in these old Byzantine lands, now under the Muslim Ottomans, were seen as allies of the Russians. And as we know all too well, the Orthodox Christians living in Ottoman lands, the literal descendants of Byzantine Orthodoxy, would themselves come to adopt this attitude, as the Serbs, the Greeks, the Bulgarians, the Romanians, and so on, all looked towards Russia, their great Orthodox father, for help in breaking the yoke of Ottoman rule. And so, when Tsar Alexander declared war on the Ottomans in April of 1877, he was simply continuing the long struggle to push the Ottoman Muslims once and for all out of Europe. Except now there was a new angle called Pan-Slavism, because not only did Russia see themselves as the great leaders of Orthodox Christianity, but now they saw themselves as the protectors of the entire Slavic people, including non-Orthodox peoples like Czechs and Poles and Slovaks and Ukrainians and so on, and radical Slavophiles like Russian ambassador to Constantinople, Count Ignatieff, were increasingly driving the course of Russian diplomacy towards a program of aggressive expansion into the South Slavic lands of the Ottoman Balkans, with the goal of liberating the Slavs living under Ottoman rule, namely the Serbs and the Bulgarians. But because the Russians had experienced a rare loss to the Ottomans 20 years earlier during the Crimean War, Russian diplomats knew that before they could launch their death blow against the Ottomans, they first had to ensure that they would not become diplomatically isolated as they had been during the Crimean War. And this diplomatic cover would unexpectedly come when British and French public opinion turned against the Ottomans in the wake of the Bulgarian horrors. With the British and the French cooling on the Ottomans, that just left the Austrians, who were strongly against a Pan-Slav agenda, as many of those non-Orthodox Slavs we just mentioned, Czechs, Poles, Slovaks, lived in the Austrian Empire. So Russian diplomats wheeled and dealed and promised that in exchange for Austrian neutrality, the Austrians could have Bosnia-Herzegovina and there would be no giant Slavic state. I repeat, it was agreed that there would be no new giant Slavic state. And so, in terms of great power involvement, the Russo-Turkish War of 1877-1878 would be a purely Russian-on-Ottoman affair, and it would actually end up being a lot closer than anyone expected. In keeping with the long tradition of the Ottoman-Russian rivalry, this war would begin in Romania, formerly the all-important Danubian principalities, where the Crimean War had started, and before that, where the Russo-Turkish War of the Greek Revolution had started, and before that, where the Russo-Turkish Wars of the Napoleonic era amidst the Serbian Revolution had started. As part of the diplomatic preparations for war with the Ottomans, the Russians had signed a treaty with the principalities of Romania, in which the Romanians agreed to allow the Russian army to pass through Romania under the condition that Russia would respect their sovereignty. So, when the Russian Imperial Army crossed into Romania on April 24, 1877, not only did it mark the beginning of the 10th Russo-Ottoman War, but it also marked the beginning of the Romanian War of Independence, as just a month later, the Romanians issued a declaration of independence and canceled their annual tribute to the Ottoman Empire, reallocating that money to the war ministry. So, the main force of the Russian invasion would first come through Romania, then cross the Danube, and finally enter the Ottoman Empire in Bulgaria. See the map at 20thCenturyRevolutions.com. And one thing that's especially interesting for us here, as we're coming out of our mini-series on the Bulgarian uprisings, is that the path of the Russian invasion through Ottoman Bulgaria will follow much the same path that Bulgarian rebels had in their guerrilla attacks going all the way back to the early Cheti uprisings of the 1860s under George Yurakovsky, and then on up to the very recent April uprising of 1876 under Stefan Stambolov, Hristo Botev, and others. So in May of 1877, the Romanian Navy would launch an attack on Ottoman gunboats along the Danube River. And this Romanian attack would clear the way for the Russian Imperial Army to cross the Great River and enter Ottoman Bulgaria. And to offer some context here, this crossing of the Russian army occurred less than 50 miles upstream from Gheorghiu, where the Bulgarian Assembly of the Apostles had first planned the April Uprising just a year and a half earlier. And it was also less than 100 miles downstream from where Hristo Botev had commandeered a vessel to transport his Cheti into Bulgaria as the final act of the April Uprising just a year earlier. So this is the bittersweet irony of this Russian invasion to liberate Bulgaria. Bulgarian rebels had been trying to garner the support of Russia for years, as revolutionary leaders knew that if they could just show the Russians, their Slavic Orthodox benefactor, that they were worthy of liberation, then maybe the Tsar would help them in their fight for independence. And now, this Russian army of liberation had finally come. But tragically, at this point, really only Stefan Stambolov and Lubin Keravelov were left to see their nation be freed, as other figures like Vasil Levski, Hristo Botev, and George Yurakovsky were destined to be martyrs. Once the Russians entered into Ottoman Bulgaria, they swept through the northern half of the province, liberating one town after another, with major battles being fought in Stefan Stambolov's hometown of Turnovo, as well as in Lovich, the old headquarters of Vasil Levski's internal revolutionary organization, and then also in Stara Zagora, where Hristo Botev and Stefan Stambolov had launched their failed precursor uprising. And in these battles, the Russians would be reinforced by Bulgarian volunteers, as many locals joined up with the Russian army as irregular soldiers, and many more participated by offering the Russians food and supplies. And this Bulgarian volunteer corps saw themselves as the descendants of George Yurakovsky's old Bulgarian legion. And this group would then go on to form the Corps of Liberated Bulgaria's Army, connecting the dots between Yurakovsky's revolutionary movement and the early Bulgarian nation-state. As the Russians moved steadily through northern Bulgaria, the Ottomans redirected their forces to try and halt the invasion. The bulk of Ottoman forces had been stationed further to the east near the Black Sea, where they had originally thought the Russians would invade. So, in central Bulgaria, where the main Russian invasion actually came, was initially not very well defended. But after the Ottomans had regrouped, they were able to slow the Russian advance through the Balkan Mountains, which cut right through Bulgaria east to west, and which had long served as a natural defense for the Ottomans against invaders hoping to reach Constantinople. So, the two armies would thereafter have a bit of a standoff in the Balkan Mountains, the old hiding place of Bulgarian Cheti rebels and Hajduk bandits. And many of these rebels and bandits who were still hiding in the Balkan Mountains would come out of hiding and join in on the Russian advance. as the Russians and the Ottomans dug in on either side of the Balkan mountain range. One of the most dramatic sequences of the war would take place at the city of Pleven, which lies in the northern foothills of the Balkans. Because the bulk of the Ottoman army had been stationed further to the east, the city of Pleven ended up being one of the few well-defended Ottoman garrisons in northern Bulgaria, because the city had been reinforced by troops from the nearby fortress at Vidin. Along with the contingent coming from Vidin, the Ottomans also redirected troops to Pleven, who had been stationed in Serbia, because you may remember that the Ottomans had just recently defeated the Serbs. So basically, what was left of the Ottoman forces in the central Balkans all flocked to Pleven, and the Ottomans were able to fend off the initial Russian effort to take the city with these consolidated forces. But the city would quickly become isolated as the Russians liberated basically every other town and city in the surrounding area. But even though the Russians quickly had Pleven completely surrounded, it was still strategically important to take the city because controlling Pleven meant controlling the quickest routes through the Balkan Mountains. And once you're through the Balkan Mountains, you're right on the doorstep of Constantinople. The Ottomans, of course, knew this, and so they hunkered down and put all of their resources towards holding the strategic city. And so began the Siege of Pleven, which would go on to last nearly 6 months. But the Siege of Pleven was not your everyday sit around and wait till they starve sort of siege, because the Russians thought that they would be able to take the city just as easily as they had taken every other city in northern Bulgaria. But the Ottomans would prove to have some fight left in them, and even though they were heavily outnumbered, the Ottomans just kept holding off all of the Russian attempts to enter the city. And though it might sound, surprising at first, this was partially due to the superiority of Ottoman weapons, as the Ottomans had adopted new rifles and artillery as part of their Tanzimat military reforms. And without wanting to get too technical with it, put simply, the Ottomans could shoot a whole lot faster than the Russians, and so, somewhat heralding what was to come in World War I, the Russian advances essentially were just getting mowed down and were suffering huge losses during their assaults on Pleven. Now facing much stiffer resistance than they had anticipated, the Russians decided to officially ask the Romanians to intervene. Even though the Romanians had allowed the Russians to cross through their territory, and their navy had helped them make it across the Danube, the Russians had been initially hesitant to ask the Romanians to officially join the war, because the Russians knew that if they did, then the Romanians would be able to make demands during the peace negotiations. And this effort to ice out the Romanians pretty nicely demonstrates what Russian intentions truly were in liberating the Ottoman Balkans. But as the Russians were making no progress in cracking into Pleven, they formally asked the Romanians to join the war, and the Romanians accepted this invitation. The arrival of the Romanians seemed to only help briefly, though, and the Ottomans were able to hold out for another 4+ months, with one Russian-Romanian attack seeing a 100,000-strong Russian-Romanian force get beaten back by a 30,000-troop Ottoman force, with the Russians and Romanians suffering over 20,000 casualties, while the Ottomans only suffered 5,000. But the determined Russians just kept bringing more and more reinforcements to Pleven, so that by October, 4 months into the siege, they had completely surrounded the city and cut off any hope of resupply for the Ottomans. Now trapped inside the city, the Ottomans would attempt one last desperate breakout. But at this point, the Ottomans were outnumbered some 5-1. And even though the Ottomans did manage to break through the initial Russian lines in this mass breakout, the numbers were just too heavily stacked against them, and they were eventually defeated, and the Ottoman commander was forced to surrender Pleven to the Russians. The Siege of Pleven holds an interesting place in Ottoman history, because strategically it was really the last hope that the Ottomans had to beat back the Russians and to prevent their invading army from making it to Constantinople. Because it's all going to be downhill from here, and the Russians would now easily cross through the Balkan Mountains and into southern Bulgaria, liberating town after town as they went, usually being welcomed by jubilant crowds made up of Bulgarians, many of whom, as we know, saw the Russians as their great Orthodox Slavic liberator. But the Siege of Pleven had taken about 5 months longer than the Russians had anticipated, and the city didn't actually fall until December. And this meant a couple of things. First, it's much harder to move an army in winter, and so progress towards Constantinople would be delayed even further. And second, the Ottomans had fought valiantly at the siege, and the news reporting on the siege helped to shift global public opinion to be a little more in favor of the Ottomans again. Then third, and perhaps most importantly, these delays allowed for international diplomatic maneuvering amongst the great powers to begin in earnest before the Russians had taken the Ottoman imperial capital. And this was critical because, as it became clear that the Russians were aiming for Constantinople, anti-Russian paranoia amongst the British was suddenly reawakened. Because while the British had been cooling on the Ottomans ever since the Bulgarian horrors, the Russians conquering Constantinople was absolutely unacceptable and went against like half a century of great game British foreign policy that had as its number one priority checking Russian expansion. And British public opinion was fickle, and the Ottoman menace could just as well become the Russian menace in the blink of an eye. But apart from these popular and slightly more emotional reactions to a Russian conquest of the great imperial city, there was also the obvious strategic angle in which Russian control of Constantinople meant Russian control of the Turkish Straits, which would be a catastrophic blow to British interests. Diplomatic, economic, military, you name it. And in addition to the British, the Austrians also began to get worried as they saw their own hegemony in the Balkans becoming threatened, and they rightly feared that the creation of a large Bulgarian state would either become a Russian satellite or an aggressive and expansionist Slavic nation-state. So, with anti-Russian feelings cropping up everywhere, the great powers began to demand that the Russians not take Constantinople, and the British would even send a fleet down to the Ottoman capital to ensure that the Russians would behave. So, had the Russians been able to ride their initial momentum in the war, sweeping through the Balkan Mountains and taking Constantinople in the summer of 1877, it is very possible that the Ottoman Empire would have fallen right then and there. And this would probably have launched Europe into a major great power war 50 years before World War I, and who knows how that would have turned out. But the Ottomans held out till winter at the Siege of Pleven, and this very well may have saved the empire from collapse. As popular British historian A.J.P. Taylor puts it, with his characteristic flair for the dramatic, quote, "Most battles confirm the way that things are going already. Pleven is one of the few engagements which changed the course of history. It is difficult to see how the Ottoman Empire could have survived in Europe if the Russians and Romanians had reached Constantinople in July. Probably it would have collapsed in Asia as well. Pleven gave the Ottoman Empire another 40 years of life." So yeah, the Siege of Pleven was a big deal, and it had this ironic legacy in which, on the one hand, it ensured Ottoman defeat in the short term, but in the long term, it breathed new life into the empire. Because once the Russians finally made it to the outskirts of Constantinople in January of 1878, there would be a British fleet waiting for them, making sure that they did not enter the city. And with recent memories of Russian isolation during the Crimean War, the Russians decided they had no choice but to temporarily bow to this British intimidation, and the Russian Imperial Army set up camp in the suburb of San Stefano, 10 miles west of the imperial capital. So as the Ottomans surrendered and began their treaty negotiations with the Russians, the mood was tense to say the least, with a massive Russian army ominously lurking just outside of Constantinople, and with a massive British fleet ominously floating in the Bosphorus. So, due to this fragile international situation, the Russians assured all of the great powers, and most especially Great Britain and Austria-Hungary, that the upcoming treaty negotiations between the Ottomans and the Russians would only be temporary, and that a great power conference would be held to ultimately agree upon a post-war settlement for the Balkans. And these preliminary treaty negotiations would culminate with the signing of the Treaty of San Stefano in March 1878. And boy, was this treaty a real doozy. As we have said many times, Austria-Hungary and Great Britain were both adamantly opposed to the creation of a large Slavic state that would either, A, become a Russian satellite, which of course the British opposed, or B, become an aggressive Slavic regional power, which could threaten Austria-Hungary's hegemony in the Balkans and potentially lead to revolutionary unrest amongst their own Slavic populations. Well, guess what the Treaty of San Stefano proposed? That's right, the creation of a massive Bulgarian principality that would cut across nearly the entire southern portion of the Balkan Peninsula, including the highly strategic and soon-to-be hotly contested region of Macedonia. This would give the new autonomous Bulgarian state access to the Aegean Sea, and therefore access to the Mediterranean Sea. And you may be saying, hey, for a brand new state, this might be kind of helpful, you know, to get their legs under them. But to the great powers, it was assumed that Bulgaria would be a Russian satellite. So the creation of this big Bulgaria meant that the Russians now would have direct access to the Mediterranean. And this was not only unacceptable to the British, as Russia's longtime imperial rival, but to France and Germany and Austria-Hungary and Italy and really everyone that was not Russian or Bulgarian. So how in the world did this happen? I mean, hadn't the Tsar been constantly telling the Austro-Hungarians and the British and everyone that they would not create a large Slavic state? Well, Count Ignatieff and the Slavophiles happened. Because Count Ignatieff was the driving personality at San Stefano, and he saw it as basically his life's mission to liberate the Slavic peoples from Ottoman tyranny and to unite these liberated Slavs under Russian protection. And for Ignatieff, the best way to do this was to create a big Bulgaria that would forever be beholden to Russia as their great benefactor, who had, for all intents and purposes, given birth to their nation. And this is an important point, because Ignatieff has a pretty mixed reputation, especially within Bulgarian historiography. Because it's easy to read Ignatieff as the great champion of Bulgarian liberation. I mean, hadn't he helped the young Stefan Stambolov return to Bulgaria to continue his revolutionary activity? And hadn't he always pressed the Tsar to help his oppressed fellow Slavs? And now he had just pushed through this huge Bulgarian state that really went beyond even the wildest dreams of Bulgarian revolutionaries. But we must remember that above all else, Ignatieff was a pragmatic and highly intelligent diplomat who always had Russian imperial expansion as his number one priority. As we've mentioned many times, Russian access to the Turkish Straits had long been the number one foreign policy priority for the Russians. A big, menacing Russian-dominated Bulgaria right on Constantinople's doorstep was a pretty darn good way of ensuring Russian dominance of the Turkish Straits. So, was Ignatieff essential to Bulgarian liberation? Absolutely. But did Ignatieff have Russian imperial expansion as his primary concern? Definitely. I mean, he's a Russian ambassador. So, the long and short of it is that Count Ignatieff and his Pan-Slavs got their way at the initial treaty negotiations at San Stefano, and the Russian Pan-Slavs had essentially anointed the Bulgarians as their preferred Slavic little brother in the Balkans. And that brings us to the other Balkan nations, because leaders in Serbia and Greece were just as upset with this post-war settlement as the Austro-Hungarians and the British. I mean, the Serbs and the Greeks didn't want a giant Bulgaria in control of Macedonia either. They wanted Macedonia. And yeah, you can see where all of this is headed. So when the Treaty of San Stefano was announced to the world, everyone freaked out. You might imagine a quiet auditorium where everyone is anxiously waiting to hear the results of a major decision. And then Count Ignatieff walks up to the podium and says, "Thank you all for your patience. After much deliberation, we have decided to create a big Bulgaria." And after a brief moment of shock, the auditorium explodes into pandemonium, with the Austrians jumping up from their seats yelling in protest, and the British storming the stage, and the Serbs and the Greeks throwing tomatoes and maybe some rocks at the Pan-Slavs. And amidst this chaos, over in the corner sits Otto von Bismarck, who slowly stands up, stoically ascends to the podium with his mustache a-quivering, and then, in a commanding and yet calm voice, he declares, "Silence! We shall have a conference in Berlin, and I shall oversee it." And so, in June of 1878, 4 months after this incredibly controversial settlement at San Stefano, the great powers would convene at the Congress of Berlin to discuss the future of the Balkan Peninsula. And as things with the great powers so often go, by the time the Congress of Berlin actually met, a lot of the agreements had already been hashed out as everyone wheeled and dealed, trying to squeeze as much as they could out of the future settlement. And this was the height of Bismarck's realpolitik, where what counted most was one's ability to project power, usually military power, on the world stage. So, those who were invited to participate in the Congress of Berlin were the Ottoman Empire, Russia, Germany, Great Britain, Austria-Hungary, France, and Italy. So that's right, none of the Balkan nations whose fate was being decided were invited to participate in this Congress. Now, representatives from Greece, Serbia, Montenegro, and Romania were invited to, like, sit and watch the deliberations, but they were offered no part in the actual decision-making process. And there is even one anecdote in which a group of Greek delegates were allowed to make a brief presentation to the Congress. But while the Greeks made their pitch for Greek territorial claims, allegedly a bunch of the delegates from the great powers were literally sleeping. In a lot of ways, this 1878 Congress of Berlin was a precursor to the Berlin Conference that would be held 6 years later, also under the mediation of Otto von Bismarck, and which would formalize the infamous Scramble for Africa, where European powers kind of randomly drew up a bunch of borders on a map of Africa, agreeing upon European spheres of influence on the continent. Well, as will be the case during the Scramble for Africa, the great power delegates at the 1878 Congress of Berlin essentially paid no attention whatsoever to local politics or local concerns. The great powers were only interested in furthering their own spheres of influence at the expense of all the other rival great powers also attending the conference. Again, this is Bismarck's realpolitik, where what matters is the ability to project power, and the new nations of the Balkans could not project military power, so their concerns were just seen as unimportant. With all of that said, let's lay down some specifics. Like I said earlier, a lot of these decisions were actually made in the negotiations leading up to the Congress. So the Congress really just made official the informal agreements that had been hashed out over the past few months. So, leading up to the Congress, the Ottomans had approached the British, their historic ally, for help. And basically, what they agreed upon was that the British would back the Ottomans in their push to severely limit the size of this autonomous big Bulgaria. And in exchange, the British would be given permission to occupy and administer the island of Cyprus. So yeah, it's like, if you help us to maintain some of our European territory, we'll give you a giant island. And this is where British Cyprus comes from, as the British will go on to control Cyprus, first as a protectorate and then as a full-fledged colony, all the way up until 1960. And then Austria-Hungary began to push for their right to control Bosnia-Herzegovina, because remember, the Russian Tsar Alexander and the Austrian Emperor Franz Josef had originally agreed that Austria would one day be allowed to annex Bosnia-Herzegovina in exchange for Austrian neutrality during the Russian-Ottoman War. So the Austrians pushed this and got their way, as it was agreed that Austria-Hungary would be allowed to occupy and administer Bosnia-Herzegovina, much like the British down in Cyprus. But these demands of the British and the Austrians were really just a sideshow to the main event, which centered around Count Ignatieff and his Pan-Slavic contingent. Because really the central priority of Bismarck and the other great powers was to check the growing influence of Russian Pan-Slavism, which they all saw as a major threat. So basically, the one thing that all the other great powers could agree on was that the creation of this big Bulgaria under Russian tutelage was absolutely unacceptable. So it was decided that the original big Bulgaria created at San Stefano would be chopped up into three different political units. So all of Macedonia, which remember was very strategically important and which at this point was coveted by the Greeks, the Serbs, and the Bulgarians, was given back to the Ottoman Empire, not as an autonomous principality, mind you, but as a province directly under Ottoman administration. Then, the region of Bulgaria south of the Balkan Mountains, which is typically referred to as Northern Thrace, was formed into a principality called Eastern Rumelia, which was to be a semi-autonomous political entity run by a governor who would be appointed by the Ottomans. And finally, this left a fairly small strip of territory to the north of the Balkan Mountains and to the south of the Danube River that was to be a fully autonomous principality of Bulgaria. And this principality of Bulgaria would operate much like the principalities of Romania and Serbia, in which Ottoman suzerainty was really only nominal. And for all intents and purposes, this principality of Bulgaria was de facto independent. And in practical terms, the Bulgarians would be much more under the thumb of the Russians than the Ottomans. And this leads us to the final decision of the Congress of Berlin. It was decided that Serbia, Romania, and Montenegro would be given full and complete independence from the Ottoman Empire. So that's right, folks. This is the moment when these three Balkan countries officially became internationally recognized independent nation states. So, Bulgaria is now an autonomous principality, and Serbia, Romania, and Montenegro are all fully independent. Balkan liberation has been achieved, eh? Everyone's pretty amped, right? Well, not really. The Bulgarians would never forget what would come to be referred to as San Stefano Bulgaria, and this brand new nation of Bulgaria would enter onto the world stage with a feeling of deep resentment towards the great powers and their neighbors in the Balkans, because they understandably felt that they had earned the right to this big Bulgaria. I mean, hadn't it been the Bulgarian revolutionaries who got all of this going in the first place with the April Uprising? And then Bulgarian volunteers had eagerly helped the Russians during their Balkan campaign from the very beginning, while the Serbs and the Greeks had hesitated, only joining the war once it was clear that the Russians would win. All of this meant that in the coming years, Bulgarian foreign policy will be most defined by a hunger for territorial expansion, driven by the belief that they had an historic right to control northern Thrace and Macedonia. Because didn't everyone just agree that these territories would be a part of Bulgaria at San Stefano? I mean, what happened? And then the Serbs, for their part, weren't happy either. Because as we talked about last week, Bosnia-Herzegovina, Macedonia, and Kosovo were all integral parts of the project of Greater Serbia. And as part of the agreement at the Congress of Berlin, Austria-Hungary was allowed to occupy Bosnia-Herzegovina, and the Ottomans maintained control of both Macedonia and Kosovo. And so the Serbs were just as pissed as the Bulgarians. I mean, hadn't it been the Serbs who had revolted in Bosnia-Herzegovina even before the Bulgarians? And hadn't the Serbs declared war on the Ottomans even before the Russians? I mean, yeah, sure, the Serbs hesitated to join the Russian war effort in 1877, but this was because the Serbs had just fought a war with the Ottomans and had lost the war mainly because the Russians, who had promised they would help, did not come to help. And these wars with the Ottomans were devastating for Serbia, ultimately creating an orphan crisis within the new country as thousands of homeless and hungry children descended upon Serbian towns and cities in the aftermath of the Serbian-Ottoman wars. And then the Greeks weren't happy either, because they also wanted to control Macedonia and felt like they had just been left out of this land grab. But they didn't have much of a leg to stand on, because while the Serbs had joined the Russian War of Liberation in December, a month and a half before San Stefano, the Greeks didn't join until January, literally just a few days before the peace negotiations began, being like, see, we joined the war. Hey, we're a part of this too, guys. Come on. And like Serbia and Bulgaria, Greece also had their own historic and ethnic claims on Macedonia. So yeah, Ottoman Macedonia is going to become a hotbed of revolutionary intrigue in the coming years. But I want to end this episode and part one of this season by looking ahead a little bit. Because World War I will be the great climax of this season on the revolutions of the Ottoman collapse, and a ton of the pieces are moving into place at the Congress of Berlin. We've got simmering resentment between Serbia and Austria-Hungary over the Austrian occupation of Bosnia-Herzegovina. This tension will bubble, 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 and then explode onto the scene with the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand in June 1914. Then, we've got the breakdown of the historic Continental Alliance bloc between Russia, Austria-Hungary, and Germany, first established way back at the Congress of Vienna after the Napoleonic Wars, and which was then re-established under Bismarck with the League of the Three Emperors. The settlement at the Congress of Berlin will leave the Russians feeling cheated by both Germany and Austria-Hungary. Because the Russians had just fought and died for what? To liberate a bunch of Slavic nation-states? I mean, sure, we love the Slavs and all, but we at least deserve control over the Turkish Straits. The Russians had literally been a step away from conquering Constantinople, and then the great powers stepped in, and what happened? Well, Britain got to occupy Cyprus, and Austria-Hungary got to occupy Bosnia-Herzegovina. I mean, they didn't even fight in the war. Now, the Russians did annex some more territory around the Black Sea, and we will talk more about the long-term significance of these annexed territories. But, like so many things at the Congress of Berlin, what would have seemed like a win just a few months earlier was now seen as a vicious betrayal. Because the Slavophiles had been riding high in the initial settlement at San Stefano, and now they had seen all of their gains snatched away because the British and the Austrians were worried about a big Slavic state. And by the way, a lot of the territory that the Russians did gain along the Black Sea had formerly been a part of the now independent Romania. So yeah, don't worry, the Romanians are also angry. So as the Russians drifted away from the Austro-Hungarians and the Germans, they began to drift towards the French and eventually the British. And boom, there you have it. The outlines of the Triple Entente are beginning to form as British, French, and Russian interests are starting to align. And with this Russian drift, Germany would become ever more reliant on Austria-Hungary and increasingly the Ottoman Empire. And boom, there you have it. The outlines of the Central Powers are beginning to form as German, Austrian, and Ottoman interests are beginning to align. But before we get to World War I, we need to put into power the leaders who will ultimately bring the Ottomans into the Great War. And for this, the Ottoman Empire needs to reach yet another crisis as a bunch of radical Western-facing secularists obsessed with scientific rationalism will take aim at the regime of Sultan Abdul Hamid. And out of the great city of Salonika, capital of the now hotly contested Ottoman region of Macedonia, will emerge the Committee of Union and Progress, who will ultimately take control of the empire and see it through to its final collapse. So join me next episode as we embark on part 2 of this season and begin the Revolution of the Young Turks.